Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, October 21st, 2016. I am still skeptical about the stories we're being told about the hacks of the DNC and John Podesta's emails blamed on Fancy Bear, and we're supposed to believe that Fancy Bear is Russia, but where is the evidence? I can't find it. Now, there's more coverage. There is more consensus. The corporate media did not fact-check Hillary Clinton's assertion that 17 intelligence agencies have confirmed Russian responsibility for the hacks of the DNC and, more recently, John Podesta's email. And let me begin by framing this in this manner. The media and our political leaders portray the United States purely as a victim of hacking by Russia, China, North Korea, whoever it happens to be. And we know that we have a very serious, aggressive, offensive cyber warfare operation. But we never discuss that and never talk about the full picture of how what is happening could be retaliation. It also could be an insider in the U.S. constellation of intelligence agencies, or one of those 400-pounders Donald Trump referred to in one of the earlier debates. And today, there's an interesting article that I've seen widely circulated on Facebook, offered up as proof, absolute proof, that these hacks are the responsibility of Russia. And I am linking to the article at Motherboard, which is a subset of Vice Media. And the author of this piece is Lorenzo Franceschi Bisciarii. And I've never heard of Lorenzo before. So I take this, just straight ahead with the usual skepticism that I apply to things like this. So he opens the piece by saying on March 19th, John Podesta received an alarming email that appeared to come from Google. And I have some Google accounts, and occasionally when I log in from a different computer, they send me a notice. Google knows who's checking into an account and from where. But this email didn't actually come from Google. It was a malicious email. And the article says here, in fact, the message came from a group of hackers that security researchers, as well as the U.S. government, believe are spies working for the Russian government. Now, that way oversells the evidence that's in the rest of this article to say, in fact. Well, let's break this sentence down. The fact that they're citing is that it came from a group of hackers. Then they go into speculative mode, saying that security researchers as well as the U.S. government believe are spies working for the Russian government. That's not a fact. That is a belief. And this is why we've got to be very careful about the coverage of these unproven assertions. Quoting again, months later, October 9, WikiLeaks began publishing thousands of Podesta's hacked emails. Almost everyone immediately pointed the finger at Russia. So? They could all be wrong. He goes on, who is suspected of being behind a long and sophisticated hacking campaign that has the apparent goal of influencing the upcoming U.S. elections. Now, again, apparent goal. That's speculative. There's no evidence of this. We don't have the leak of a document from the FSB, Russian intelligence, detailing how, we're going to muck up the American elections. This is pure speculation from the American side, and it is stoked by political rhetoric from the Democratic message machine. The article continues, but there was no public evidence proving the same group that targeted the DNC was behind the hack on Podesta until now. So I will acknowledge that this article provides some interesting information that appears to show that it was the same people responsible for the DNC and the Podesta hacks. But that doesn't prove anything, because the identifications we have for these alleged hackers are Fancy Bear, APT-28, we'll call that Apartment 28, or SOFACY, spelled S-O-F-A-C-Y. The article provides interesting information that the malicious email that Podesta clicked on essentially then allowed the hackers into his account. And I've linked to this, so if you're techie, you can read it and you can get all wonked up, because it shows how they used Bitly. And for the average person, Bitly is the short URL code that you'll find used on Facebook or Twitter that substitutes for a much longer URL. You know what I mean? So they go on to say that the link to Podesta was one of 9,000 links that Fancy Bear used to target almost 4,000 individuals over a seven-month period from October last year to May of this year. And they claim that the hackers forgot to set accounts to private, according to SecureWorks, a security firm that's been tracking Fancy Bear for the last year, and this is what has enabled them to identify Fancy Bear as the source. Now, I don't know who made up the name Fancy Bear. Bear is a, you know, it's a subconscious suggestion of Russia. But what if they'd called it a fancy turtle? Or a fancy Mazda? I mean, this stuff really is the product of what could be Hollywood screenwriters or people with similar imaginations. So this story continues. SecureWorks was tracking known Fancy Bear command and control domains. One of these led to a Bitly short link, which led to the Bitly account, which led to the thousands of Bitly URLs that were later connected to a variety of attacks, including on the Clinton campaign. Now, let me pause right there. We have a Bitly short link, a Bitly account, and thousands of Bitly URLs. At each stage of this, sophisticated IP communications professionals, technology experts, they know how to fake an IP address so that if it looks like it's coming from Ukraine, it actually could be coming from a basement in Louisville, Kentucky, or in Shanghai, China. We really don't know, because each connection that I just described, and, of course, many others along the route, allow for a misdirected IP address. And if you use encryption systems and other ways of obscuring the entry point to the Internet of a certain piece of traffic, well, I remain unconvinced by this. Now, one of the things that's interesting is they show that a guy named Reinhardt, who worked at the DNC, got one of these emails, and it shows that the origin, it says it's an email from Google. Someone has your password. Hi, William. Someone just used your password to try to sign into your Google account. And it gives an address. It gives the date, Tuesday, 22nd of March. It gives an IP address, and then says location, Ukraine. Now, I'm telling you for the first time today that over the last 4 months, my webmaster, John Gorenfeld, has detected efforts to hack into the peterbcollins.com website from Ukraine. And we have taken steps. We added security features to our website. And I want to thank George Mashke, a listener who lives in Holland, who suggested that to me. But just because it says it came from Ukraine doesn't mean that's where it originated. And we can't assume, given the status of Ukraine today, that Russia is responsible for something that originated in Ukraine. And if I have made you dizzy and confused, I apologize, but this is the nature of the so-called evidence that's being put forward that Russia is firmly responsible for these activities. And so... buried here, I printed this story out. It's 13 pages long. And on page 9, it finally gets to this disclaimer, which undermines the claims that were made earlier in the article and in the headline. Quote, "None of this new data constitutes a smoking gun that can clearly frame Russia as the culprit behind the almost unprecedented hacking campaign that has hit the DNC and several other targets somewhat connected to the U.S. presidential campaign." And so I remain skeptical. I remain unconvinced. I am in the sway of Bill Binney and others who were high-level officers at the NSA. And I'm going to try to get another interview with Bill Binney to get his latest take, including on this particular article. Now, whether it was Fancy Bear Apartment 28 or anybody else, we've seen a massive campaign to make Russia the boogeyman, to link Trump to Russia in ways that are really far-fetched. And as you can tell, I'm not buying it. Now, one of the other suggestions, implications, inferences, and suspicions that has been embraced by the corporate media, we now have to see them pedal back on. And that is that this guy, Harold Martin, who is under arrest, former NSA contractor for Booz Allen Hamilton, he collected all kinds of classified information and kept it at home. And when he was arrested at the end of August, we were told it was part of the investigation into shadow brokers, the still unidentified group that claims to possess NSA hacking tools, and we'll get to them in a moment. There's been a recent communique from them. And so it appears that if Harold Martin had some connection to shadow brokers, that he wasn't in charge of it or the central figure because they're still sending messages while he is locked up. There's a hearing today where his lawyers are going to try to get him sprung. The government has pressed or is prepared to file new charges that he violated the Espionage Act and committed other felonies that could leave him in prison for decades. And the weight of those charges, I think, is likely to cause the court to deny him bail. That's just my impression at this point. But we're told that Martin had an arsenal of 10 firearms at his home, that he had recently bought a police-style automobile, and that he had so much information, and Jason Leopold breaks this down over at Vice News, that it pales in comparison to the other leaks that have occurred so far. They're claiming that he stole 50,000 gigabytes of data. 1 gigabyte is about 10,000 pages. That's a whole shipload of information, friends. And we're only getting the government side of the story, as usual. But they're saying that this shows felonious conduct, breathtaking in its longevity and scale. According to the government, in addition to numerous digital media devices that they seized from Martin, there were also hard copy documents that were seized from various locations that comprised 6 full banker's boxes full of documents. Some of them were marked unclassified, others secret, top secret. Many of the secret and top secret also bear special handling caveats. There's also a printed email chain marked as top secret, containing highly sensitive information, and then there is the connection that now appears more tenuous to the shadow broker's investigation. He recently purchased a police package detective special Chevrolet Caprice. I guess he was planning a getaway of some sort, or that's what they want us to believe. So here's the only real quote that we've seen from Harold Martin. In 2007, and this is coming from the government, so we have to take this with some skepticism. He said, "I've seen pretty much all your tech secrets without regard to computer security. Thanks. You made me a much better InfoSec information security practitioner. In exchange, well, I gave you my time, and you failed to allow me to help you. You are missing most of the basics in security practice while thinking you are the best. It's the bread and butter stuff that will trip you up. Trust me on this. Seen it." Then he says, "Dudes, dudettes, I can't make this any plainer. Listen up. They are inside the perimeter. If you don't get obnoxious, obvious, and detrimental to my future, then I will not bring you into the light." This is kind of weird stream of consciousness stuff. So we'll see how that case plays out. But here's the latest from Shadow Brokers, and I've linked to my source here. It is a Silicon Valley publication called SiliconANGLE. And it reads, the shadow brokers has abandoned efforts to auction off the hacking tools it stole from the NSA and is now running a crowdfunding campaign instead to raise about $6 million or 10,000 Bitcoin. The group says it stole the hacking tools in August, claimed to have obtained many, many Equation Group cyber weapons, and they offered some samples that we covered back at the time. And according to the Russian-based Kaspersky Lab, this is quite a source to cite in this story, these are the most advanced hacking, this is the most advanced hacking group that they've ever seen, with evidence of their links to the NSA. So a confirmation of the hack came from Cisco Systems, which issued a warning. And here is the communique in its broken English. The Shadow Brokers is not being interested in fame. The Shadow Brokers is selling to be making money, and you peoples is never hearing from the Shadow Brokers again. The Shadow Brokers is being disappointed peoples no seeing novelty of auction solution. Auction is designed for to make benefit the Shadow Brokers. In a separate post on Medium, quote, again verbatim, the Shadow Brokers is being bored with auction, so no more auction. Auction off. Auction finish. Auction done. No winners. So who is wanting password? The Shadow Brokers is publicly posting the password when received 10,000 Bitcoin. Same Bitcoin address, same file, password is crowdfunding. They put their password up. Sharing risk, sharing reward, everyone winning. Now, I don't know how to decipher this stuff. My point is that Shadow Brokers is still able to put out its mangled English statements, and so it raises serious questions about whether Harold Martin has any connection to them. Of course, it could be a fake. It could be something that Harold Martin put in motion before he got arrested, and who knows? My point is that these consistent claims pointing at Russia are unproven and appear to be overheated political rhetoric that may turn out to be flatly false. And as it heightens tensions with Russia, this could be a very, very serious issue going forward. Over at Shadowproof, Kevin Gostola has been monitoring the statements of John Podesta and other Democrats about the email hack. And very consistently, when they're questioned on cable news, many of them appeared before the debate on Wednesday, they automatically shift to the talking points about Russia. So Podesta was on CNN with The Wolf on October 19th, just hours before the third debate. Podesta told Wolf Blitzer, the Department of Homeland Security and Office of DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, have indicated the hack came from Russian sources. They're in cahoots with WikiLeaks. No proof. Just statements that nobody bothers to repudiate. And then Blitzer asked, have any of the emails or transcripts that have been released been doctored, or are they accurate? And then Podesta shifted the discussion to, well, when this first came out, it started with a lie from Julian Assange, which was, you know, that I was co-owner of the Podesta Group, which is just factually and completely untrue. But what about the emails, Johnny? That was the question, not about whether you own the Podesta Group. And so what Kevin shows here in some detail is that there is this coordinated messaging from the Clinton campaign where they take umbrage when you ask about the emails. Here's Neera Tanden, who said some really mean things about Hillary in emails to Podesta. You know, I know that Russia and other forces would love us to have a debate. This is exactly what they want. They want us to have a debate about the internal structure of Hillary's campaign, what's true, what's not true, and I'm just not going to play that. And so many Clinton loyalists just take this at face value. They don't think critically, and they just follow like sheep. And that's what the Clinton campaign is counting on. Can they keep the sheep in the herd until the 8th of November? I want to issue a correction here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Yesterday, based on an email I received from John in Sacramento, I mentioned to you that the FBI's investigation notes into the Clinton emails included commentary that named Barack Obama as someone who had a personal account and a private email. And I need to correct that because I didn't read John's email carefully enough to note that he had substituted Obama's name in the text of these documents. His name actually fits in the areas that were redacted. But that's not any proof that Obama was in the original version of this document. And it's not any proof that he had a private email address or a private email account. And so I regret that I ran with that story. And to the extent that you may have been misled by my comments, you have my deepest apology.
Excuse me.
And with that apology in mind, I'd like to thank the people who continue to support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Cynthia Von Hendricks, Abby McMillan, Paul Tomaselli, Natalie Real. They're all loyal subscribers to this podcast, and I really appreciate your support. And maybe it's your turn. You've been putting it off for a while? Take 5 minutes and click over to peterbcollins.com. You pull down on the menu, you pull down the tab that says Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page. You'll see our bonus books for new annual subscribers in the continental U.S. who sign up for a $50 annual subscription. And I invite you to support this and help validate the work I do and cover the costs of the internet servers and all the other gizmos and gear that I need to bring you this podcast every day. And for my subscribers, I'm releasing today the latest in-depth interview with documentary filmmaker Craig Atkinson. I highly recommend his new film called Do Not Resist. And he does a documentary without the Michael Moore stand-up guy who offers his own commentary or bias. There isn't even a narrator. He shows you scenes and lets you draw your own inferences and conclusions. He starts off in Ferguson, Missouri, and he shows the militarized response to the protests there. He goes on ride-alongs with SWAT teams that bust into people's houses and ruin their lives over very small amounts of weed, often based on inaccurate intelligence that led them to conduct that raid. And in this excerpt from a wide-ranging conversation, which really impressed me, Craig Atkinson understands the issues of our creeping police state, and he argues that one of the fundamentals is what he calls for-profit policing.
You would see young officers, you know, signing up to protect and serve, and then the top-down objectives that they were given either through the department or through the feds completely put them at odds with their community. And, you know, more often than not, it had to do with for-profit style of policing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that you're going to, you know, solve the issues within policing unless you address that. Because, you know, in many communities, we're treating citizens like ATMs, and you're asking the police to be basically the de facto tax collector in a community. When you see in our film the police, you know, using civil asset forfeiture to take $100 or $876 from an individual, that person has a responsibility to prove that that money wasn't used in a drug crime. Well, it's very difficult to do that, and it actually might take $3,000 to do that in a court of law. And so, you know, there's no, you know, emphasis to do this. The civil asset forfeiture piece actually made sense originally. The idea was you would take criminals' money and put it into a general fund for your city and be able to make, you know, build schools and roads and things like that. Well, the Fed stepped in number of years ago and said, you know, if you include one federal agent on your task force, then you don't have to put that money in a general city. You put it, you can go 80% of it right back to your police department, and we'll take 20% of that for, as a kickback system. So mm-hmm. Here you are now in 2014, and it was the first year, 2014 that is, that American citizens had more money taken from them through asset forfeiture than they did through burglary. So $5.1 billion were seized from American citizens through asset forfeiture in 2014. Only $3.5 billion was taken through burglary. So you've completely flipped the system, and you've created a for-profit policing system. And now the first wave was with the military equipment, and now the second wave is for the surveillance equipment. One I saw as a way to harvest wealth out of the low-income community, and I think that the surveillance technology could be used to harvest the wealth out of middle class and you know, upper middle class, wealth as well. So I don't think that we're going to get beyond the policing issues if we still have the mechanism in place where police officers are required to, you know, raise funds for their failing department.
You can hear the full interview with Craig Atkinson released to my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, wherever you find the podcast. It's going to be there. By the way, the in-depth interviews aren't on YouTube, and there are reasons for that, but it's not worth telling you. You can just get the Daily News and Comment podcast on YouTube. And if you're intrigued by the Craig Atkinson interview, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Here's the latest in our expanding police state. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is on track to start collecting information associated with the online presence of travelers from countries who have a visa waiver program. And that includes much of Europe and a handful of other countries who are considered our allies, nations that we don't have high suspicions of a terrorist originating from. And this is going to make our international relations even more difficult because those countries that we impose these kinds of restrictions on will turn around and impose them on us. Critics say that the new effort would chill online expression. It gives the government overbroad authority to determine what kind of online activity constitutes a risk to the United States or nefarious activity. And if they can force someone who comes in from France to disgorge their social media information, then we know the capabilities our government has. And they can track who the friends are on Twitter or Facebook, for example, of the individual that they're looking at. And if you look at my own case, I don't filter people who ask to be my friend on Facebook. There are a lot of right-wing loonies and anarchist nuts and other people, and I actually enjoy hearing their seeing their posts and hearing their views, but I don't agree with them. I don't embrace them. And so will the government hold you responsible when they do the one-hop or two-hop test for who your alleged friends are on Facebook? And if you liked a post that they consider to be offensive to the United States or somehow detrimental, what'll be the response? And this boils down to potential thought crimes, not even actual thought crimes. So this is a very chilling program. It hasn't been launched yet. It just cleared a comment period and is expected to go into effect in the near future. The corporate media is taking the bait from James O'Keefe and his latest doctored video, which shows a couple of political operatives, Democrats in the Midwest, who make comments that are quite embarrassing but reveal no criminal activity. Scott Fovell is this guy from Wisconsin who calls himself a Democratic operative. He talked about ways that they sent people in provocative T-shirts to Trump rallies trying to provoke violence. There's no evidence of this. He talked about busing people around to vote in multiple locations. There's no evidence of that. And it ties into a guy who I guess he is linked to on campaigns, Bob Creamer from Chicago. And I've known Bob for many years. He's the husband of Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. He did a little jail time for fraud that he committed back around 2004 or 2005. And while these videos are embarrassing, like the Planned Parenthood videos, like the others that James O'Keefe has created in the past, I think this is an attempt to create an October surprise. And frankly, I am not surprised. I am surprised by this, though. The Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C. took a case that had been an overturn of a Guantanamo conviction from a small panel of that appeals court. And when they held the en banc hearings, which means everybody on that appeals court gets to review it, that group upheld a military commission's conviction of a Guantanamo Bay prisoner on the charge of conspiracy to commit war crimes. Now, the Supreme Court and international law are both quite clear. conspiracy to commit a war crime did not exist in the U.S. law books until 2008-2009. And they are trying to retroactively convict a guy who was an associate of Al-Qaeda. He made a propaganda video about the Kohl bombing in 2000. He gave loyalty oaths, we're told, to several of the September 11th hijackers. And yet, the government has seen most of the charges against this man overturned on appeal. And the only thing left is this really flimsy conspiracy charge, which is not legitimate because it wasn't in effect at the time that the alleged crimes occurred. And so this appeals court, en banc, dominated by four Republican appointees, including a monster named Janice Rogers Brown, who used to serve on the California Supreme Court. Bush elevated her. And what they have done is created new law. They are upholding this conspiracy charge despite the very clear nature that it's not legitimate. And I'm very sorry to see that. I don't know if you've ever seen The Week. The Week is an interesting publication that recaps the news of the week. It's written in a very neutral, nonpartisan style. And I want to commend The Week because Damon Linker, one of their writers, has a piece this week. And let me just read the opener here. In an election flush with conspiracy theories, here's one that's real. Both major party nominees, as well as the journalists who cover the election and moderate the debates, are actively conspiring to avoid talking about the fact that the United States is waging war in at least five countries simultaneously: Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia. In the first two debates, there was a brief mention of the Syrian civil war, the Iran nuclear deal, and Russia. A little bit about Libya in the past tense. Buddy says our role in advising the Iraqi army a few miles behind the front lines as it works to take back territory from ISIS, our secret war against Shahab militants in Somalia, our support for Saudi Arabia's bloody assault on Houthi rebels in Yemen, our airstrikes pounding positions in and around the state of Sirte, the city of Sirte on the Libyan coast? Nada, zip, nothing. And he notes, Republicans have an incentive to avoid a conversation because it's politically advantageous to portray Obama as a feckless commander-in-chief. Democrats have their own reasons to avoid conversation because they fear the American people might object if they realize that the Democratic administration was meddling militarily in so many places, and because it's their guy in the White House. So I think this is a spot-on piece. I hope you'll take a look and see what you think as well. Now, we are hearing that Russia has agreed to extend its pause in bombing Aleppo in Syria for up to 4 days. They've expanded the daily window to 11 hours. I guess that means 13 hours they can bomb. And the people in Aleppo seem to be wary of the intentions of the Russians and fear that they won't be protected if they leave their homes. And so it's more of a stalemate. And while I support any temporary pause in the violence, it appears that Russia and Syria are intent on really leveling Aleppo. And the effort to get the Islamic State and other rogue fighters out of Aleppo, based on an offer of safe passage by the UN Special Envoy, has not occurred. Meanwhile, the action in Mosul is being a little bit overshadowed by today's assault on Kirkuk by Islamic State forces. This appears to be an effort to distract and cause a diversion, as all of the focus is on retaking Mosul. And so it shows that the Islamic State is wily and resourceful and capable of the kind of sneak attack that Donald Trump thinks we should have used in this much-publicized assault to retake the city of Mosul. I'll also note that the front page on the New York Times today, Washington Bureau Chief David Sanger has an analysis piece describing how Hillary Clinton would enter the White House as the most contentious and hostile leader in terms of attitudes toward Russia since the Cold War. And finally, today, as you may know, I spent many years in Chicago, went to Northwestern University, worked in radio there in the 1970s, and one of the people I got to meet only once was Phil Chess, who, together with his brother, founded Chess Records. And Chess Records was responsible for the discovery of some of the greatest American blues and R&B performers: Muddy Waters, Bo Diddley, Sonny Boy Williamson, Etta James, Willie Dixon, Howlin' Wolf, Chuck Berry. And I want to mention one other discovery of Chess Records, a woman with a beautiful voice named Minnie Riperton, and she died young in the 1970s of cancer. But she had an amazing voice that she lent to a psychedelic project that was one of the most unusual things that came out of Chess Records in the 1960s. And it was a fabulous piece of kind of psychedelic music and recording. And in it, we heard Minnie Riperton's voice wailing away. She then got a solo contract and had a couple of minor hits in the 1970s before she died. But I'm very grateful to Phil Chess for the music that he helped bring to white audiences. And also, Phil and his brother owned a radio station in Chicago, WSDM-FM. They owned it for 10 or 15 years, and they played jazz and kind of light rock and roll. And the different thing about WSDM was that all the DJs were females. And we wouldn't get away with it today, but it billed itself as the station with the girls. And I'm still in touch with one of those girls, Penny Wayne Julin, Penny Lane Julin. She married Wayne Julin, that's why I made that mistake. She was one of the fun people who made that radio station really special. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.